Time to start. Will you take your syllabus, please, and turn to page 14. Page 14, we're going to be dealing with the framing of the Constitution. In the standard textbooks that you'll read today, I'm thinking particularly of young people here, high schoolers, and college students, you will find that the normal approach to our Constitution and to modern democratic institutions in the United States, they'll refer you back largely to Thomas Jefferson, and then we'll hark back from Jefferson to John Locke. John Locke was a writer in England. He died about 1704. He preceded our writers of our Constitution by approximately 100 years. And he was an Anglican Christian. He considered himself an Anglican Christian, and he took the ideas of empiricism, that is, the scientific method, and he began to apply them to politics. And what our standard text tried to do is to say that he is the source of the contract theory of government. And the liberal tradition and the humanists, the secular humanists of today, will say that the church, rather than contributing to democratic ideas, hindered. And we had to get the church out of the way and theology out of the way before we could have. The thesis of this whole series is that that is absolutely false historically, and very easy to document that it is false historically, and it has been part of the effort of what we've been doing here. Now, this is particularly true in the framing of the Constitution of the United States, which is present tense, the basic written law of the United States, the basic document that declares what law is in the United States. Okay? So, I want to change that order. By the way, we owe a great debt of gratitude to Jane and Nancy for putting together this syllabus. I bought a Mac computer, so our computer would be compatible, and I shoot them off the disks, and they know how to put it all together and lay it all out and everything, and they worked hard on this. I appreciate what they did for me. And I sent them this capital A on the framing of the Constitution. You never have a capital A unless you have a capital B under it, right? English teachers, outliners, etc., and other nitpickers that are essential. Hey, I love English teachers. Some of the most spiritual and most influential people in my life have been English teachers. God has this mold in the womb, and he predetermines and predestines that this person will be an English teacher, so you can describe them pretty nicely, you know. They're nitpickers. They're good for us. Roving maverick type mentalities like mine, they were good for me. Enough of that rabbit. I'm changing this. There were three great major theological influences on its drafting. First of all, was the depravity of man, which we'll show. The second was the belief in the authority of Scripture. And the third one was the deity of Jesus Christ and the providence of God. But I'm going to change this because I think it will help us in the theme that we've been following. So under the framework of the Constitution, we're going to talk first of all about the representatives themselves, the reps at the Constitutional Convention, the reps, representatives themselves. Who were they? Okay? Now, one man who has documented this extremely well is William Warren Sweet. In his book, The Religion in the Development of American Culture, it's in the bibliography, and here is what he documents relative to the framers of the Constitution. There were 19 Episcopalians, I'll have to abbreviate here, sorry for that. 8 Congregationalists, 7 Presbyterians, 2 Roman Catholics, 2 Quakers, 1 Methodist, 1 Dutch Reformed, and 1 Deist, 1 professed Deist. Now, we all know that because somebody has a tag, like say you have a Lutheran tag, or even say you have a Protestant tag, sometimes the tag doesn't mean a hoot. It doesn't mean a thing. Tags don't mean a whole lot. It's what you really, it's what makes your heart beat faster. It's what sort of grips your soul. That's what you really believe. I used to tell students they'd be shooting pool, and the students say, I should be studying. And because I like to shoot pool, I'd say, I'd be there too. And I said, you really don't believe that. And they said, what do you mean you don't believe that? I said, if you really believed it in the biblical sense, you'd be studying. You could be here shooting pool. You act, what you believe is what you act upon in your life. So don't deceive yourself. Now the issue then is, were these men overly influenced by the French philosophes, by the radical secularists of France, whose ideas were totally sectarian, get rid of the clergy, get rid of our authority, we'll set up our new authority. Were they so influenced by them that the Constitution really owes its influence to that lineage, or were they, I don't like to use the word religious people, were they involved with the ideas of Christianity? Let's put it that way. The answer is emphatically yes. These were not just nominal Christians. Hugh Williamson from North Carolina was a Presbyterian minister. Charles Cotworth Pinckney was the president of the Charleston Bible Society in South Carolina. John Dickinson from Pennsylvania was a Quaker minister. William Few from Georgia insisted that they discuss the inspiration and authority of the scriptures. Roger Shaman from Connecticut objected to having any type of meetings on Sunday. He was an absolute categorical congregational who believed in all the blue laws. And by the way, in Connecticut at the time, if you didn't go to church on Sunday, they'd fine you 20 shillings. I'm not here to advocate state church. I don't believe in a state church. I detest a state church. I believe in liberty, freedom, non-coercion of the will. These men believed in state churches. What I'm trying to say is that Washington and Franklin and Madison and Hamilton and Dixon and Mullins and John Rutledge and Roger Sherman and George Mason was a deist. But these others were men who feared God and walked quietly before him. These were the men, the reps, who made up the Constitutional Convention from which we get our document. The second thing I want to show is the climate of opinion. Now, were they representative next of the climate of opinion? You see, we could say today, how many in Washington, D.C. reflect our climate of opinion in terms of moral values, centralized authority versus state and local authority? How many in Washington represent? Were these representative of the climate of opinion? I would like to read to you some statements about the climate of opinion that precedes climate of opinion. Is this written large enough for y'all to see it? I'm not sure. A climate of opinion would be a prevailing concept in a culture, in a society. And I'm dealing now with the climate of opinion before 1785, before the writing of the Constitution. Will you listen to this? In New England, the Congregational Church was the established state church in New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. Massachusetts does not get rid of the state church until 1833. Leap beyond the Constitution. Connecticut, 1818, and New Hampshire, 1817. Now, do you think for 1 minute that those states are going to send representatives to the Constitutional Congress that don't agree with their understanding of what government and society should be like? Why, it's obvious. They're going to be send somebody that's in agreement with their system. And their system was permeated with the concept of the Bible state and Calvinistic doctrine. We inherit from the Puritans all the outflow of a Calvinistic mentality in American society. And this is the liberals, this just eats their heart out. They can't tolerate that. I'm not saying that I agree with all of that mentality. I'm just saying what was prevalent during the writing of the Constitution. Would you listen to this statement? In South Carolina, their Constitution, now this is the state constitution of 1778. The Christian Protestant religion shall be deemed the established religion of the state. It further said that no religious society could become a church unless, quote, that there is one eternal God, that there is a future state of rewards and punishment, that the Christian religion is the true religion, that the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament are by divine inspiration. State Constitution of South Carolina, 1778. South Carolina also asserted that, quote, no person who denies the existence of a supreme being shall hold any office in this state under this constitution. In Maryland, 1776, it was decreed that, quote, a general and equal tax shall be laid for the support of the Christian religion. In New Jersey expressed the idea of toleration by saying, quote, no Protestant inhabitant of this colony shall be denied the enjoyment of any civil right. Does that say anything about anybody else? No Protestant. It let out a lot of people, didn't it? Massachusetts in 1780 authorized a special levy to support, Protestant teachers of piety, religion, and morality. That same formula was adopted in New Hampshire. Vermont was not admitted into the Union until 1791. It was one of the more liberal states in terms of this attitude, politically and theologically. But the oath of office was this in Vermont, quote, I do believe in one God, the creator of the universe, the rewarder of good and punisher of the wicked. I do acknowledge the scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration, and I am to profess the Protestant religion. End of quote. Quaker Pennsylvania, which was noted for its toleration from its inception. You had to be a Trinitarian to run for office, but you could live there if you weren't, wasn't. 1790 said this, no person who acknowledges being of God in a future state of rewards and punishment shall, on account of his religious sentiments, be disqualified to hold any office or place of trust under this common wealth. And before that, to run for office, you had to believe in the deity of Jesus Christ and the inspiration and authority of the Old and the New Testament, and that was also true in New Jersey. That's if you want to run, you weren't planning for admission to a seminary. You just wanted to run for office. Now, does that tell you, that's before the Constitution. Do you think for 1 minute any of these states is going to send somebody to a constitutional convention that's going to formulate what this government is going to be like that was not in agreement with the Constitution, with this climate of opinion? Absolutely not. What about the climate of opinion after 1800? Now, I only bring this out because if what secular humanists are saying today, and say the effort today, of course, is to separate God and government, or to separate government from any concept of God. Now they won't say it that way, they'll say religion. I don't like the word religion. And the point of any thinking Christian is you cannot separate government from morality. If you are going to govern somebody, there is a morality that you must follow. You will follow a morality. It may be an immorality, but it will be some form of morality. And from a Christian point of view, you cannot separate morality from God. You cannot separate it from Jesus Christ. So there has to be some mitigating balance there in the government for you to have a healthy culture. We're going to be dealing with that, I hope, before we get through with this. What was the climate of opinion after 1800? If the secular humanists are right, then once the Constitution is drafted, since these people have been so influenced by Jefferson and by Locke and by the philosophers and by the anti-clergy ideas that were part of France, won't it just sort of like run rampant? Answer, no. It won't run rampant because of several things. One, the Second Great Awakening occurs right at the beginning of the 19th century, right around 1801. It starts in a college at Yale, where Timothy Dwight worked, or I think he was president at the time. And the Second Great Awakening runs through the colleges. And again, and then it spreads to the frontier. Now on the frontier, it gets quite emotional. The Baptists and the Methodists take over. Sorry, folks. I'm not against emotions. I refuse to give up my emotional response to the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and the sensitivity I understand when somebody talks about the grace of God. I'm going to let all the Pentecostals have fun and respond to that emotionally? No way. I respond. I'm not going to let somebody rob me of that blessing. Bible talks about the blessed man. That means the happy, full-armed person. How'd I get off on that rabbit? Lord. The revivals became very emotional. I mean, all kind of weird stuff went on the frontier. And then Charles Finney comes along, and his theology is so wacko that it gets worse. They begin to have a penitence bench. And you would sit on that bench because you were under conviction. Then they would have a martyr's bench. Then they'd have these altar calls, you know, sing one more song. I think there's somebody here that ought to be saved. We want you to come forward. And there develops in evangelicalism the concept of structured confession of faith. Come forward and confess Christ as your Savior. As though that's biblical confession. That's not biblical confession. That's a structured confession. That is a form of coercion. And those of you here that are unsaved and you resist it, I'd probably take a seat with you and hold your hand and say, I'm in agreement with you. We don't coerce people to believe on Jesus Christ by any psychological tricks. We believe that you must be convinced. And that God, the Holy Spirit, the only person who can, brings you to a personal conviction that without Jesus Christ, you are totally lost and undone and rightfully guilty before God. You are without hope in the world. You are lost. And there's only one person that can save you, and that is Jesus Christ. And until you come to that conviction, which manifests itself in trust, you're never saved. I don't, you go forward, cry at an altar, get emotional, do whatever you want. Doesn't save you. You don't get saved by receiving Jesus Christ in your heart. You get saved by believing on Him. Totally different. It's a volitional response to the cross and the significance of the cross. And if you don't understand that, you have nothing to believe. So there can still, you see, we have this history of revivalism in our culture. We still have it today. I am not against evangelists. I'm not against trying to get people to believe on Christ. That's the business I'm in. As long as there's sin, we're going to be in business. So business ought to be good for us. Now, what was the climate of opinion after 1800 in America? I'm going to refer you to two works. I'm going to read from one. These two books are two of my most exciting books of the 19th century in America, and they're both written by foreigners. And those of you who are in college will recognize the first one, Alexis de Tocqueville. Democracy in America. This ought to be required reading for every high school student. My daughter is now reading in high school, and I happened to find a paper that she was throwing away. She's a senior. She's reporting on this, and she says, boy, is this thing boring. I don't know anything about raising teenagers. I've raised two families now, and I've, you know, six kids. I just decided, Lord, I just don't know anything about this. I mean, no, forget it. Lord, they're in your hands. I've done my best. Forget it. And if you don't believe that I don't know anything, just ask about my teenage daughters. They'll be happy to tell you how dumb I am about it. But I got two here that reached beyond that. You're going to get to hear them sing. Oh, man, I tell you. Folks, when you look at your teenager at 17 or so, and don't say, how did you end up this way? They haven't ended up yet. James Bryce, boy, are these guys something else, I'll tell you. His book is The American Commonwealth. These men are separated in time by about 60 years in the 19th century. This is a huge book. Both of these are rather largish. Alexis de Tocqueville was an aristocrat from France. That meant in his day that he was one of the economic elect. He had the bucks. It also meant in his day that he had the education. Extremely well-educated man. And he decides to come to America around 1820 and just find out what the heck's going on over there. Now, he's in France, see? Because France now has run the gamut. They've gone from radical revolution, bloodbath, anarchy, crowning of a prostitute in the Cathedral of Notre Dame as the goddess of reason, the guillotine, you know. Here's the country that believes in liberty, equality, and fraternity, and is the hero of Western civilization. Well, come on. Within 10 years, they crowned Napoleon emperor. Then we have guys like Napoleon III and de Gaulle. It just bugs me that you go to France, you know, and they all sort of look down their nose at you, and they have to remind them, hey, we boiled your guts out twice. Well, this guy was from France. He was no village idiot, I'll tell you. And he says, I'm going and I'll document everything. I said, no, he didn't have a tape recorder. You know, he couldn't go around doing these interviews. He had to ride on his thing. You know? He didn't even have the roads. He had to come and ride on a horse and take a horse and buggy. Can you imagine how the streets must have smelled? They didn't have a lot of sewers either for the houses. Can you imagine how the flies? Talk about environmental protection. And this guy goes everywhere. He doesn't go to New York. Well, he goes to New York, but gee, you know, would you, if you wanted to teach somebody what America's all about, would you send them to New York City? Good Lord, that'd be the last place. That's a foreign country. If I wanted to tell somebody what America was like, I'd say go out to Texas, start down in South Texas, and go up to Minneapolis. That's what America's about, because that's the melting pot. That's where people say, hey, we will not be controlled by the Eastern establishment. Who do you people think you are? Our Constitution was written to protect us from centralized government and from manipulating our lives, running our schools. Look how they run them right into the ground. I told people to start Christian schools. Don't sell your school on the basis of Christianity. Sell it on the basis of education. Hey, we'll teach your kids how to read. We'll teach your kids how to write. We'll teach them what a noun is. We'll teach them what a preposition is, what a direct object is, how you make a sentence, how you make a paragraph. In other words, we'll teach them the basics. You can sell a school on the basis of that today, couldn't you? I'm not familiar here in Kansas City, but I know you can do it most places I've learned. Well, de Tocqueville does all this, and in 1830 he publishes that book. Now, what did he say? I'm sorry, 1835 this is published. Here's what he says. There is no country, now he's out of France, now listen. There is no country in the world where the Christian religion retains a greater influence over the souls of men than in America. He was struck not just by the fact of Christianity, but by the character of the Christianity. In France, he wrote, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. Just what our modern liberals are telling us. Just what, unfortunately, the Supreme Court seems to be telling us by some of the things they're coming up with. But in America, back to the quote, I found they were intimately united and that they reigned in common over the same country. That is, what reigned in common? The spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom. And what religion is he talking about, folks? What is he talking about? Roman Catholicism? Absolutely categorical no. Because those two things do not go hand in hand with that. He was talking about biblical-based religion because that's what was predominantly in the United States everywhere. De Tocqueville goes on. Religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society. That's because of Amendment Number 1, right? But it must be regarded as the first of their political institutions. For if it does not impart a taste of freedom, it facilitates the use of it. I do not know whether all Americans have a sincere faith in their religion. See, he's from France. He uses the word religion. He says, I don't know. Who can search the human heart to determine this? But I am certain that they hold it indispensable to the maintenance of Republican institutions. Page 336, Democracy in America. Read it yourself. This is a foreigner writer. This is a foreigner commenting on the climate of opinion in the first half of the 19th century America. At the end of the 19th century America, James Bryce comes over. Now, James Bryce, boy, it must be nice to be in this economic elect. It's Lord James Bryce, very wealthy Britisher. And he comes at the end of the century, and he's in pursuit of this same thing. And he writes this marvelous book. I don't have time to read from it, so just I just encourage you to read it. He will echo a lot of things that was said by Alexis de Tocqueville. Any questions about what we said so far? We're talking about the framing of the Constitution. All right, let's take one more step. What did we do here? The reps, the climate of opinion before, the climate of opinion after. And what we're saying in all of these, there is a basic biblical concept of Christianity that pervades the mentality of the people responsible for the Constitution. And the culture reaffirms it. Point D, the idea of contract theory. The idea of contract theory. If you are going to read any, if you are going to be knowledgeable about the happenings in Western civilization in the last 200 years, you must get involved with the idea of contract theory, that government is responsible to the governed, that rulers rule by consent of the governed. You have to get involved with that theory. And we're encouraged by secular humanists that were it not for these motivators along this line, like John Locke and Jefferson, we would not have any freedom today. And what we're saying is that's totally false. And I want to try to show that to you. Contract theory, first of all, did not originate with John Locke, if you want to take a note. 1632 to 1704 were his dates. He merely popularized it for the English in his second treatise on civil government. Contract theory did not originate with John Locke. Now, John Locke was greatly influential upon the man who wrote the Constitution, particularly Thomas Jefferson. He was influential on Jonathan Edwards, the great Puritan preacher in Northampton in the First Great Awakening. John Locke helped sway Jonathan Edwards from his position of the sovereignty of God in the affairs of men to open a door to the fact that there is a certain level of sovereignty among the people that are being governed. And once Jonathan Edwards accepted that fact, he became influential in swaying the mind of the Congregationalists to contract government. See, a Puritan felt that God was so sovereign in the choice of a king that they didn't have any right in saying anything about it when they first started. Now, where do we get contract theory? In the Bible, what is the word that's used for contract? Covenant. Very good. Covenant. And the first contract theory that I know anything about in history is the Sinaitic Covenant. Now, covenant, as we said, both in Hebrew, Bereshith, and in Greek, diatheke, means a contract. And to have a contract, you always have to have two parties, correct? What are the two parties in the Sinaitic Covenant? God giving the law to Israel. He did not give the law to the Greeks. He didn't give it to the Romans. He didn't give it to the Persians. He gave it to Israel. He gave it by divine revelation. And this law is a contract between Israel and God. And God says, folks, what do I want you to do? And he tells them a whole bunch of things. Exodus 19 through 25. And then he says to them, where to go? Right? And what did they say? Yeah, they're the first promise keepers. Sure, we'll do it, Lord. Okay, hey Moses, come on back up. Moses goes up the top, comes down, and they're having a sex orgy. A graven image. They love having a sex orgy, but to have it religiously? Come on. They just agreed they wouldn't keep all these promises. Should have seen right away they needed the grace of God and salvation. Should have been, and Moses got kind of mad, didn't he, huh? Threw down the table of stone. Okay. Was that a contract? Agreement? I will be your governor. You will be my people if. Here's where we're going. Now, down through the in time, perhaps one of the best expressions that we can identify is the Magnificent Charter or the Magna or the Great Charter. The Magna Charter or the Magna Carta. I'll mix them both. It's one Latin and one English. In the early 13th century in England, the nobility kind of got sick of a king named John, and they said, hey, you got to quit shoving us around. This is a landmark in the growth of Western freedom. This was not a product of paganism, but a product of Christians in England with biblical ideas. And one of the first things they do is they publish a list, a catalog of safeguards. 63 under the first article dealing with religious liberty. Did you know that? You bet. The Magna Carta includes a catalog of legal rights, taxation by consent. You see, it lays the basis for English common law, which, as I said, was greatly respected by the Puritans, and which is the basis, of course, of our law, harking back to Judeo-Christianity and to Roman law. Okay? In other words, in the Magna Carta, 13th century England, you have the idea that the law is above the king. That is a biblical concept. Okay? The Magna Carta was a feudal product. It was not a product, by the way, of pagan Plato or Aristotle or ancient Greece. It was a product of feudal England. And the only reason that John agreed to it was it was either there or these guys were going to wipe him out. They had enough military strength to wipe him out. So he agreed to it. All of this precedes John Locke. What else precedes John Locke? The Swiss Cantons. You want to go to a place that believes in democratic, republican form of government? Go to Switzerland sometimes. They had hundreds of years before we did. These ideas did not originate with John Locke. They were, and even Thomas Jefferson says the idea of contract theory is old and well established and known by everybody, except some of the modern historians. The German am I using ABC? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. German confederacies understood contract or basic contract things. They had to agree, if they were going to be in confederacy, what their rights were and what they weren't. Before there was any Germany. There was no Germany, you know, until 1870. There was no Italy until 1870. What am I trying to show? What am I trying to illustrate? I'm trying to illustrate that the idea of contract theory did not originate with John Locke, as most of you high school kids will be exposed to, and college kids, that it had a longevity, a long period of history. These were influential on the writers of the Constitution. All right? Now, theology then played a great part. Now I've got to go back and see how A, B, C. We're looking for D, E. I changed all this morning. This is new to me, folks. I mean, I've never done this before, so in a local church, and so it's new to me, so you have to bear with me. We're doing better, aren't we? We have a capital A, B, C, D. Aren't you glad for English teachers that taught you to be orderly? And, you know, you first went to school, you start scribbling all these notes, and they say, well, I have a test next week. Oh, God, I got to go back to my notes. Oh, geez, I can't make head or tails out of these notes. What in the world does this relate to? Oh, I forgot to put a heading up here. Oh, gosh. Does anybody have any good notes? Oh, I don't do it that way, do you not? When you just go, you say, can anybody get me one of these tests? I'll give you $10 if you get me one of the tests. Or you're assigned to read a book and you say, what's the thing you got to get the summary of the book? Is that honest? Did that help you in your education? No. Who got hurt? You. Did the system promote it? Yes. Does the system have integrity in it? No. Does anybody have a degree? Yes. Do they know anything? No. Do they have an education? No. But they got a degree. Oh, hallelujah. We all have to have a degree. Please call me doctor. And who prevents it? The preachers, the ministers. Oh, this is Dr. So-and-so. I was in a school. I had a master's degree. I earned a master's degree. I was working on my second in preparation for a PhD. And a guy came to the school and says, "Oh, we got to get you a doctor's degree." "Oh, you do?" "Yeah." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Why did you?" He says, "Well, you know, it connotates something." I says, "What does it connotate?" "Well, it connotates, you know, that you're learned." I said, "You mean you get the degree and that connotates I'm learned?" "Well, if I'm not learned, I got the degree and I'm a village idiot. You think the American public are so stupid that because I have a degree and I stand up, what are people, idiots?" And he says, "Well, you know, we got to have this image." I says, "We don't have an image, we got God. We got to be truthful." So I went to the dean of the school and I said, "You know what, that idiot that brought in here for the PR stuff, he wanted to get me a degree from down in Puerto Rico or somewhere." I says, "God must be nuts." And here I'm talking to a guy who just agreed to take one. Folks, that's worldly. That's cosmic mentality. Do you believe in integrity? I told him I won't take any degree unless I earn it. And I'm not even a nurse, so don't call me a doctor yet, for crying out loud. It's ridiculous. Well, I'm going to give you one major doctrine bearing on the Constitution. On the framers. Depravity. There is not a man who went to the Constitutional Convention, except maybe the one deist, who didn't believe that men are totally, hopelessly depraved. And that power corrupts. And that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so when they framed the Constitution, they said, we have to protect ourselves from ourselves. There needs to be a system of checks and balances in government, because unchecked power leads to corruption, even as corruption fosters unchecked power. And all you need to do is get arrested in Mexico and thrown in jail, and you'll know what that means. It's also crooked. I have a friend that's here that wanted to go That's going to be another rabbit. I'll back off. Don't have time. I had to warn him, don't go by yourself. Don't go in a vehicle that looks like it has money in it. Take along somebody who speaks Spanish. Don't stop on any of the roads. Don't stop if there's trash in the roads. They'll find a reason to arrest you, confiscate your vehicle, and sell it while you're in jail. They'll put drugs in it and say you have drugs in it, therefore it's their possession, and they'll sell it. By the time you get out of jail, you won't even go hitchhike your way home. If you don't think corruption, unchecked power leads to corruption. These men said, we will have checks and balances, and so depravity manifests itself in a constitutional device that says we will have executive, we will have legislature, we will have judicial. What about the corruption that possibly can come from aristocracy versus the common people? Did they recognize it? Oh, man, they had arguments galore. How are we going to keep the aristocracy from lording it over the common man? And thanks to men like Thomas Paine and so on, they went to war with words. And they said, well, we'll create two houses, and the two houses will balance out this problem between aristocracy and the common people. We must have a federal government to prevent insurrections. Aristocracies and Democrats would neutralize each other, and this will be our form of government. Why? Because they knew that that men were depraved. They knew that they had to put a check on the power of the federal government. And to make sure that that happened, they added the what? Bill of Rights to the Constitution. And we'll have to take up the first of the Bill of Rights when we come back. I'm supposed to stop now and give you a break, and I'm sorry we don't have time for questions. In the morning session, we're going to be dealing with the biblical philosophy of history from the book of Acts. I hope you can be here for that session. Tonight, we're going to try to wind this thing up. I have an awful lot more material, but we'll wind it up. We'll do it somehow, and maybe tie some loose ends together. You're dismissed. I hope you'll be back at 11:02. Thank you very much.